So what they did is that they decided to do two large trials, which are called Confirm 1 and Confirm 2. Confirm 1 was in previously untreated patients with metastatic colorectal cancer. Confirm 2 was in second line in patients who had metastatic colorectal cancer. Confirm 1 was 5-FU and oxaliplatin in the FOLFOX4 regimen, which is the label actually indication for oxaliplatin. They were then randomized to receive either PDK-ZK at 1,250 milligrams per day or a placebo. It's actually a placebo-controlled trial. There was the identical regimen with Confirm 2. And with that regimen, those patients had to have failed 5-FU and irinotecan. So one trial was a first-line trial. The other trial was a second-line trial, but identical regimens.
And prior to those two trials, what clinical research had been done looking at combining PTK-ZK with chemotherapy?
There were several phase two trials that had been done. The question is, what is your endpoint for a phase two trial? Classically, it's been response rate. But if you have a class of drugs whose primary benefit may be by disease stabilization, a classic phase two will tell you something about toxicity of those combinations. It may give you some hints of activity, but since there's no control arm, it's very difficult to know how to take that. And that is a crucial problem with drug development right now, is how do we design trials somewhere between the 40-patient phase two and the 1,000-patient phase three? Because obviously the costs are only going to be so many large phase threes.
I'm curious, just, you know, sort of your overall impression when you had looked at those phase two data, did it look to you that there was maybe more effect than you'd expect with the chemo alone?
I think looking at the phase twos, I never expected to really see much. I mean, it was clearly in the ballpark of what we were looking at. On the other hand, if you look at the phase twos that have been done with these combinations, 5-FU oxaliplatin, 5-FU irinotecan, there's a big range of response rates. So there were no home runs by any means with that. So it wasn't like you had an 80% response rate or something like that. But it wasn't such that I was disappointed. I think more importantly, what it also was able to show was that tolerable toxicity. You know, the classic phase one, you may have 3 patients or 6 patients at the highest dose. That doesn't tell you very much. On the other hand, at least 40 or 50 patients is going to tell you something about the toxicity of combining drugs. And that's another really important thing out of the phase two. Now, the confirmed trials, remember, these were initiated before bevacizumab was available. So the standard of care at that time, at least in the United States, was pretty much 5-FU oxaliplatin, though some people were also using 5-FU and irinotecan. I have to say these were global trials, not just in the United States, but also done in Europe and other places as well. So the results which I presented, the Confirm 1 trial, was actually looking at a new endpoint. Classically, what the FDA has looked at in colorectal cancer trials has been survival as an endpoint. For example, the addition of bevacizumab to IFL showed an improvement in survival, a very hard endpoint. The 9741 trial of FOLFOX4 versus IFL, which Rich Goldberg presented and published, showed an improvement in survival, a very hard endpoint. The problem is that now we have more and more drugs. And as you have more and more options, the problem as seen in breast cancer, it becomes more and more difficult to control for the noise that happens after you progress. So the FDA has actually become more accepting of other surrogate endpoints. It generally has not. And the one that they were willing to at least take a look at was progression-free survival. Now, progression-free survival in most studies, particularly large cooperative group studies, has been done like by investigator, and it's a little bit sloppy. And, you know, there's a lot of either you're alive or you're dead. It's a very hard endpoint. Progression, how you measure the tumor and things like that, there's a lot more wiggle room with that. So in order to do that, they had to have a very rigorous way of measuring progression-free survival in these trials. And what they did is that, first of all, they used a central read, so it was completely blinded to what the patient was doing clinically. The other thing that was done was that they were very conservative about missed data points, and it's called backdating. And the final progression-free survival showed an improvement in progression-free survival. However, this is one of the two primary endpoints. The two primary endpoints were progression-free survival, hoping the FDA would take that, as well as overall survival. The only one that's back yet is progression-free survival, and that's what I presented at ASCO in 2005. So We still don't have the overall survival data yet. But the progression-free survival showed a hazard ratio of 0.88, which was not statistically significant. By investigator, which is a more common way of looking at it, actually did reach statistical significance. However, the primary endpoint was not reached, which was progression-free survival by central review. The overall progression-free survival was in the 7 to 8 month range. However, what you're looking for is you're looking for a single number to describe a curve. You say, what's the median? But that's actually, from a clinical standpoint, that's actually not a very good number for a couple reasons. First of all, most people don't progress at the median. Very few actually do. The second of all is that that may work best in lines that are straight. But if you have curved lines or lines that have stair steps with them, it happens that right at the median, the two lines come together. So therefore, for most complicated curves, the hazard ratio, which looks at basically the difference between the two lines over the entire curve, is a much more accurate way of looking at that.